Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our fortnightly Sunday discussion group hosted by the Consistent Democrats. This week we're going to be discussing the penultimate chapter of Trotsky's Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 10. Ian is going to speak for about half an hour, and then so if there's anything you want to say, I suggest you take a note of anything you want to say while he's talking. And then I will open it up for discussion. I recommend where possible that people mute while they're not talking. Okay. Without further ado, go ahead, Ian.
Okay, well, this chapter is chapter 10 of the Revolution Betrayed, which is titled The Soviet Union in the Mirror of the New Constitution. And the chapter's best dealt with as a whole, in my view, is it contains a basically unitary theme concerned with Stalin's new constitution of the USSR, which was approved in June 1936, having been announced at the beginning of the year. And it signified how the Stalin regime was both distorting reality and distorting communist politics in order to miseducate and mislead the working class of the Soviet Union and the international labour movements. The miseducation is there from the very beginning of the Constitution, with the definition of socialism itself, which it sums up as being, in quotes, in the Soviet Union, the principle of socialism is realised, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his work. And in this chapter, Trotsky attacks that as a nonsensical formula. He says it signifies a major lowering of the theoretical level, and it simply is a lie, actually, which imbues the new constitution. It's a lie on about what socialism means. Because Marx employed the formula for communism of from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. And Trotsky maintains that the two halves of that formula are inseparable. In the communist sense, work becomes a prime need of human existence, and society has no need for any compulsion. That will be the fate of labour under communism. And no one will be refusing work except those who are unwell, as work will be something enjoyable and fulfilling. Work according to their abilities will be work with the highest technique available to produce to provide a genuine standard of living, a generous standard of living for all, according to their needs, without humiliating control of people. Whereas the Soviet state, when this slogan or motto or whatever it is was propagated, was far closer to a backward capitalism than to communism. And therefore the communist formula, which we just talked about, was unthinkable. It cannot permit its citizens to work according to their abilities. Instead, it instituted such systems as piecework under the catchwork of basically, the watchword is basically get out of everybody as much as you can and give them in exchange as little as possible. That is the ethos of piecework. It's true, I suppose, in one sense, that you can't make people work in absolute physical and psychical terms beyond their possible abilities. But that's also true of capitalism, of course. It cannot go beyond limits set by nature. But Trotsky says, wage labour does not cease even under the Soviet regime to wear the humiliating label of slavery. Payment according to work, in reality, payment to the advantage of intellectual, as opposed to at the expense of physical labour, and especially unskilled work, is a source of injustice, oppression, and compulsion for the majority, and privileges and a happy life for the few. So he summarises this and says, instead of frankly acknowledging that bourgeois norms of labour and distribution still prevail in the Soviet Union, the authors of the Constitution have cut this integral communist principle in two halves, postponed the second half to an indefinite future, declared the first half already realised, mechanically hitched onto it the capitalism law of piecework payment, named the whole thing principle of socialism, and upon this falsification erected the structure of their constitution. And in this regard, Trotsky talks about the significance of Article 10, which guarantees the personal property of citizens from arbitrary invasion or arbitrary expropriation, that is, by the bureaucracy. That's what he's talking about. He says, under a genuinely socialist regime, the personal and consumer goods property of all citizens would likewise be guaranteed. But Trotsky doubted whether, under high culture, people would burden themselves with a rubbish of luxuries, as he puts it. However, he does note that the first task of communism is to guarantee the comforts of life to all. But this constitutional clause in the new constitution recognises reality when it says that, quote, the personal property of the peasants and the not well-off city people is the target of outrageous arbitrary acts on behalf of the bureaucracy, which its lower steps frequently assures by such means its own relative comforts. That is the reality that this is dealing with. The bureaucracy was being driven by an acquisitive petty bourgeois, not a socialist ethos. But this has potentially unpredictable social consequences, which this clause simply aims to avoid those social consequences, which needed to be limited so that personal accumulations, instead of being something completely arbitrary, can become a stimulus to increase the productivity of labour. So the upshot of this is that a protection by law of the hut, the cow, and the home furnishings of the peasant, worker, or clerical worker also legalises the townhouse of the bureaucrat, his summer home, his automobile, and all the other objects of personal consumption and comfort appropriated by him on the basis of the socialist principle, from each according to his abilities to each according to his work. The bureaucrat's automobile will certainly be protected by the new fundamental law more effectively than the peasant's wagon. And that's the point he makes. Now, part two of this chapter talks about the ideological regression in the 1936 Constitution. And as Trotsky notes, it's a regression in the sense that he says, from the Soviet system of election according to class and industrial groups to the system of bourgeois democracy based upon the so-called universal, equal and direct vote of an atomized population. And he concludes that this amounts to, in effect, this is what he says, it amounts to juridically liquidating the dictatorship of the proletariat. Because it's based on myth-making and mystification. The argument being that in expropriating the capitalists, the proletariat actually did enter upon its liquidation as a class. Which, of course, is true. That is what we believe. That's what Marxists have always believed about the proletarian revolution will begin that process. But as he points out, as Trotsky points out, from liquidation in principle to actual dissolution in society is a road that is more prolonged the longer the new state is compelled to carry out the rudimentary work of capitalism. And in reality, he points out that the Soviet proletariat still exists as a class deeply distinct from the peasantry, the technical intelligentsia, and the bureaucracy. And moreover, it's the sole class interested right up to the end in the victory of socialism. So therefore, he notes that the new constitution wants to dissolve this class in the nation politically, long before it's economically dissolved in society. And Somewhat inconsistently, the regime continues to call this state with the name Soviet. But that's at odds with what the Constitution is trying to do. And this is terminological dishonesty. So he says, well, the various local bodies which are supposed to be elected are municipalities, dumas, zemstvos, but they're not Soviets. Soviets are specifically organisations of the workers as a class, separate from other classes. Trotsky notes that it could be the case that if the proletariat were particularly strong socially, this change could be simply formal. But in that case, the state ought to be in the process of withering away. Again, quoting him in full, he says, of itself, an equalization of the political rights of workers and peasants might not destroy the social nature of the state if the influence of the proletariat on the country was sufficiently guaranteed by the general state of economy and culture. The development of socialism certainly ought to proceed in that direction. But if the proletariat, while remaining a minority of the population, is really ceasing to need political ascendancy in order to guarantee a socialist course of social life, that means that the very need of state compulsion is reducing itself to nothing, giving place to cultural discipline. But that was not true. In fact, the opposite was the case. He noted that the Constitution contains guarantees of freedom of speech, of the press, and of street processions, i.e. of demonstrations. But the reality was as follows. This is what he says. He says, freedom of the press means a continuation of the fierce advanced censorship whose chains are held by the secretariat of a central committee who nobody has elected. Freedom of Byzantine flattery is, of course, fully guaranteed. Meanwhile, the innumerable articles, speeches, and letters of Lenin, ending in his testament, will continue under the new constitution to be locked up, merely because they rub the new leaders the wrong way. That being the case with Lenin, it's unnecessary to speak about other authors. Freedom of assemblies will mean, as formerly, the obligation of certain groups of the population to appear at meetings summoned by the authorities for the adoption of resolutions prepared in advance. So effectively, that changes the character of the regime. And he says, he spells it out. He says, it's no longer to be a class dictatorship, but a people's dictatorship. But when the bearer of dictatorship becomes the people, freed from class contradictions, they can only mean the dissolution of the dictatorship in a socialist society. And above all, the liquidation of the bureaucracy. That thus teaches the Marxian doctrine. And he quotes Lenin's party, the party program at the time of Lenin, which said this. It said, deprivation of political rights and all other limitations of freedom whatsoever are necessary exclusively in the form of temporary measures, in proportion as the objective possibility of the exploitation of man by man disappears, the necessity of these temporary measures will also disappear. And thus, the arrival of a socialist society is characterized not only by the fact that the peasants are put on an equality with the workers and that political rights are restored to the small percentage of citizens of bourgeois origin, but above all by the fact that real freedom is established for the whole 100% of the population. With the liquidation of classes, not only the bureaucracy dies away, not only the dictatorship, but the state itself dies away. But as everybody knows, that's completely at odds with what was happening in the USSR at that time. He spells out, he says, well, let some imprudent person, however, try to utter a hint in this direction. The GPU will find adequate grounds in the new constitution to send into one of the innumerable concentration camps. Classes are abolished. Of Soviets, there remains only a name. But the bureaucracy is still there. The equality of the rights of workers and peasants means, in reality, an equal lack of rights before the bureaucracy. And then he talks about the secret ballot. Because under the Soviet system in the early days, when it was actually the proper Soviet system, it was actually based on Soviets, he notes this. He notes that the old Soviet constitution saw in open voting, as in the limitation of elective rights, a weapon of the revolutionary class against bourgeois and petty bourgeois enemies. But the new constitution introduced the secret ballot. And the question then arose, as he asked, who is feared by a socialist people who have recently thrown off a czar, a nobility, and the bourgeoisie? And he answers his own question in this way. He says, in a capitalist society, the secret ballot is meant to defend the exploited from the terror of the exploited, of the exploiters. If the bureaucracy finally adopted such a reform, obviously under pressure from the masses, it's only because it became interested in protecting its state, at least partly from the demoralisation introduced by itself. But in a socialist society, there can be, it would seem, no terror of the exploiters. From whom is it necessary to defend the Soviet citizens? The answer is clear, from the bureaucracy. And then Stalin basically admits this, but he says somebody asked him the question, why are secret elections necessary? And he says, it's because we intend to give the Soviet people full freedom to vote for those who they want to elect. Which begs the question, who exactly is this we who can give or not give the people a free ballot? Trotsky answers that again when he says, it's that same bureaucracy in whose name Stalin speaks and acts. The exposure of this applies to the ruling party exactly as it does to the state. For Stalin himself occupies the post of General Secretary of the party with the help of a system that does not permit the members to elect whom they want. In this incautious phrase lies the actual constitution of the Soviet Union as it's been drawn up, not upon paper, but in the struggle of living forces. Now, we're getting on to part three, which deals more extensively with this reality. Trotsky noted that from the beginning of the Soviet state, the party in reality exercised a monopoly of power. And he elaborates on that this. He says, during the first period of the Soviet era, the Bolshevik party also exercised a monopoly. But to identify these two phenomena, will be to take appearance for reality. The prohibition of opposition parties was a temporary measure dictated by conditions of civil war, blockade, intervention and famine. The ruling party, representing in that period a genuine organisation of the proletarian vanguard, had a living, full-blooded inner life, a struggle of groups and factions to a certain degree replaced the struggle of parties. Whereas by 1936, this had changed considerably because, as he points out, he says, at present, when socialism has conquered fully and finally and irrevocably, the formation of factions is punished with concentration camp or firing squad. The prohibition of other parties, far from being a temporary evil, has been erected into a principle. The right to occupy themselves in political questions has even been withdrawn from the communist youth. And at that very moment of publication of the new constitution, politics is thus once and for all declared the monopoly of an uncontrolled bureaucracy. So Stalin justifies this by saying the following. He says, where there are not several classes, there cannot be several parties, for a party is part of a class. But Trotsky says about that, Trotsky notes from this that Stalin is saying that classes are homogeneous and remarks that the Marxist teaching of the class nature of the party is thus turned into a caricature. In reality, classes are heterogeneous. They're torn by inner antagonisms. They arrive at the solution of common problems not otherwise than through an inner struggle of tendencies, groups and parties. It's possible, with certain qualifications, to concede that a party is part of a class. But since a class has many parts, Some look forward, some look backwards. One at the same time may one class at the same time may create several parties, for the same reason that one party may rest upon parts of different classes. An example of one party corresponding to one class is not to be found in the whole history of political theory, providing, of course, you do not take the police appearance for the reality. And as he points out, examples are many, you know. In the social structure, the proletariat is the least heterogeneous of class of capitalist society. Nevertheless, the presence of such little strata as the workers' aristocracy, the workers' bureaucracy, is sufficient to give rise to opportunistic parties, which are converted by the course of things into one of the weapons of bourgeois domination. It's from this difference that the necessity arose in its time for breaking with social democracy and creating the Third International. But nevertheless, Stalin insists that there can only be one party because there are no classes in the USSR. And Trotsky's response to that is to say this: it follows only that there can be no different parties in the Soviet Union, but there can't even be one party, because when there are no classes, in general, there's no place for politics. But nevertheless, Stalin's conclusion was to defend the monopoly of a single party, which he was general secretary. Whereas Bukharin, conversely, argued that under socialism, partisans of the hostile liquidated classes cannot be permitted. As Trotsky said, in a country of triumphant socialism, partisans of capitalism would be merely ludicrous Don Quixote type figures incapable of creating a party. Whereas the real question, where if there were a healthy regime, was how do you go towards socialism, with what tempo, etc. The choice of the road is no less important than the choice of the goal. Who is going to choose the road? If the nourishing soil for political parties has really disappeared, then there's no reason to forbid them, is there? On the contrary, it's time, in accordance with the party programme, to, quote, abolish all limitations of freedom whatsoever. So, a French journalist asked Stalin about the, I think it was Stalin, not sure actually, about the role of factions in the ruling party. I don't think it was Stalin. He asked, if there's not to be a struggle of parties, perhaps the different factions within the one party can reveal themselves at these democratic elections. And actually it was Molotov he was asking, and he responded that the party was a unit. And Trotsky remarked that this is proved best of all by the numerous purgations and concentration camps. After the commentary of Molotov, the mechanics of democracy are completely clear. He then goes on to note that the questions of the mutual relations of classes and parties have been dragged in by the hair, and that it's not a question of sociology, but of material interests. The ruling party, which enjoys a monopoly in the Soviet Union, is the political machine of the bureaucracy. And that's the point. So, Trotsky concludes by talking about the purpose of the new constitution. And he summarised it in a couple of passages, which I've sort of clipped a bit, but I think it makes the point. He says this. He says, in abolishing the Soviets, the new constitution dissolves the workers in the general mass of the population. Politically, the Soviets, to be sure, long ago lost their significance. With the growth of new social antagonisms and the awakening of a new generation, they might again come to life. Most of all, of course, are to be feared the city Soviets, with increasing participation of fresh and demanding communist youth. In the cities, The contrast between luxury and want is too clear to the eyes. The first concern of the Soviet aristocracy is to get rid of worker and Red Army Soviets. With the discontent of the scattered rural population, it's much easier to deal. The collectivized peasants can even, with some success, be used against the city workers. This is not the first time that a bureaucratic reaction has relied upon the city in its struggle relied upon the countryside in its struggle against the city. And he notes the domestic purpose of this echoes the politics of the bureaucracy on the world scale. As he says, representing as it does an immense step backward from socialist to bourgeois principles, the new constitution, cut and sewed to the measure of the ruling group, follows the same historic course as the abandonment of world revolution in favour of the League of Nations, the restoration of the bourgeois family, the substitution of the standing army for the militia, the resurrection of ranks and decorations, and the growth of inequality. By juridically reinforcing the absolutism of a, quotes, extra-class bureaucracy, the constitution creates the political premises for the birth of a new possessing class. I mean, that took decades to happen, you know. Such was the power of the revolution. It didn't really surface for another half a century, actually, but that really did anticipate, ultimately, what happened to the Soviet Union. And I'll wind up there. Hopefully we can have a discussion on all that. Thank you, comrades.
Well done, Ian. Ian, before I open it up for discussion, I understand we have a statement from one of our regular attendees who nevertheless can't be here but has written a statement based on the text. Do you want to read that out now?
Sure, it's not very long. Okay, this is from Marie, and it is on the same chapter on Revolution Betrayed, chapter 10. In three parts. She says, this is my contribution to the discussion. Someone may perhaps post it into the chat of the room. Actually, I will do that. I will also read it out in a second. Let me put it into the chat. Here's the chat. The question is whether it will fit, because I think it's rather long. No, it will fit. Looks like it, anyway. Has it gone? No, it's too long, I think. Yeah, it's much too long. I'll read it out. Yeah, I'll post it in three chunks. Give me a minute or two, and I'll post it in three chunks.
While you're doing that, allow me to remind comrades that this meeting is being recorded. So, as always, please try to keep the comments to one at a time, preferably by using a virtual hand. But if you're on camera, I will be able to see you in any case.
Mm-hmm. If you want to carry on, I will carry on. If anybody wants to speak, carry on speaking, because I will. I'll put this up in chunks, because it is a little bit long for the word limit on the. That's too long. You see, I need to do this.
Shall I open it up for discussion while you're doing that, and then. Yeah. Those of us who are present right now, who want to start? I know Diana's got her hand up, so go ahead, Diana. Good afternoon.
From each according to their ability to each according to their need, I've never thought too deeply about that, what that means. Until I saw Trotsky in this article saying that people only can work according to their ability. But under slavery and capitalism with dire working conditions, particularly in the time of Engels in Manchester, you could argue that you could say that people were being worked beyond their ability because their lives were severely shortened. In fact, it goes both ways, both beyond their ability and not as much as their ability, because they were so damaged that they couldn't. The working conditions would leave people so damaged that they couldn't work as well as they might have been if they'd been left to work at a healthy level.
Thanks, Diana. Does anyone else want to come in? Can't see anyone. Ian, are you ready to read out the statement?
I will read it out, yes. I will read. It's quite long, actually. It's longer than I thought. yes, I will read it out now. I'll read it out. That's probably the best thing to do. Okay, this is Chapter 10, Revolution Betrayed, 1936, three parts. This is my contribution to the discussion by Marie. She says this. She says, Trotsky analyses here the new constitution of 11th June 1936. From a scientific analysis, he imparts the knowledge that bourgeois norms are bound to continue for a time in a worker state on its way to socialism. One should not hide the fact or pretend this is not happening by calling socialism such a worker state. Trotsky proceeds with the details of his scientific analysis based on Marx's theoretical conclusion that in expropriating the capitalist, the proletariat enters upon its own liquidation as a class. But the Soviet experience shows, Trotsky finds, that in this process of expropriation, the road is more prolonged the longer the state is compelled to carry out the rudimentary work of capitalism. It seems to me that when us, ourselves, and our comrades of the future come to face a similar situation, the transitory road will be made much shorter by the same token because, quote, the rudimentary work of capitalism would have been done long ago. The mastery of production, of the need to for the unity of the world, will become very strong instead. Trotsky continues on the basis of Marx. In the abilities of each, Marx recognizes the human craving of each for the development of one's own personal creativity as part of the all-sided development of society. It is capitalism and bureaucracy who view human and animal abilities as a property out there to be snatched at, appropriated, and made to serve their ends. A primordial act of violence, according to me. Bureaucracy does not do this for a capitalist aim, but it uses the necessity to continue with piecework, to each according to their capacity, in the name of socialism. The bureaucracy refuses to simply acknowledge that this is not yet socialism, that it cannot be socialism, because if it did, it would have to acknowledge inequality continuing and privileges according to some, and worst of all, a world policy of violent and deadly opposition to the continuation of revolutions in the world. A very bloody historic retreat takes place when the bureaucratic layer of the workers' state causes the constitution of the workers' state to stop being proletarian and to become national. I'll just move down a bit more on this. Parliamentary and bourgeois elections are reinstituted and the Soviets left to wither away, keeping the name to hide the substitute, the subterfuge. A dictatorship imposes itself inside such a workers' state against the workers, denying them their right to lead society and act in solidarity with the workers of the world. It turns the workers again into beasts of labour, whom it wants to keep submitted and stupid. Some of the bloodiest consequences can be seen today. imperialism relied on such a workers' state not supporting the 1926 general strike in Britain. The costs are still with us. Recently, it led to Yugoslavia being blown up by NATO, with each piece made to fall under the yoke of a capitalist power, each piece being led to war against the other. Today, the lack of workers' state power in the world leads imperialism to feeling entitled to eliminate those in society who it regards as a drain upon their profits, or like Gaza, a place where to exterminate those in the way of Rivieras. To have called the workers' state socialism was not a mistake. It was a dishonesty and a historic crime. To hide the continuing appropriation of the wealth by a few who mock Marx in the name of communism. And that's by Marie on the 12th of August, 12th of April, I should say. Thank you, comrades.
Thank you, Ian, and thank for Comrade Marie for sending that into us. Does anyone else want to contribute to the debate? Can't see anyone.
Sorry, I'll raise my hand. You don't have any responses, Ian, to Marie's points?
You're in a few minutes.
Okay, one of the questions I would ask is, Trotsky's writing this in 1936, am I right? So, I don't know whether it's before, it's obviously after Hitler has come to power and the National Socialist Party in Germany has taken control. And is Trotsky writing this in order to differentiate communism from National Socialism, which is something we're still fighting with on the far right, who insist on trying to have their cake and eat it. But the real point is, when they're asking for elections and the secret ballot, are they trying to contrast themselves with the fact that by 1936, Germany's National Socialist, i.e., that it was the Nazis were already claiming, you know, were already a dictatorship, and therefore there was a need to distance themselves? Or am I just being confused by the whole, you know, what his criticism?
Ian, do you want to come back in on that?
I will come back on that, because what Trotsky is criticising Stalin for is two things. One is liquidating Soviet democracy, right? And that's why he points out that under the revolutionary Soviet regime, where the party was based on workers' Soviets, they didn't actually have a secret ballot. People would actually put their hand up openly and vote for what they wanted to vote for, you know, like in a mass meeting of the trade union or whatever. Whereas what Stalin had instituted, you know, this had decayed, obviously, as the Soviets had decayed, and basically, political life in practice had begun to be run by the bureaucracy, right? And there was nothing they could really do to hide this, except for obviously censorship of the media, etc., etc. But they had no ideological response to people who said, "Well, yeah, people are just being stuff is being decided arbitrarily, right?" So what the 1936 Constitution did is it said, "Okay, we're going to do everything by secret ballots. We're going to defend, and people have the formal legal rights that they do under bourgeois democracy to do this, this, and this." In practice, it wasn't true, but the ideological form of it was the same as bourgeois democracy. And Soviets were effectively declared, although they used the word Soviet, everybody was declared to be equal. Well, under the dictatorship of the proletariat, everybody is not equal. The working class is the ruling class. And the old bourgeoisie and the the remnants of the old ruling parties are enemies of the state and are denied the right of political organisation. And the peasantry is regarded as an ally of the proletariat, but it is not the fundamental ruling class of the state. And the projects of socialism will do away with a, over time, through economic developments, with a petty bourgeois peasantry. It will proletarianize the peasantry, as it were, and create a basis for the dissolution of classes, right? So this idea, the secret ballot, in a Soviet democracy, you don't need a secret ballot because people just vote for what they want, you know. The secret ballot, it assumes that there's some tyranny in the background which will attack people, for, you know, victimise people according to what they vote for. And of course there is, it's the bureaucracy. But it hides itself, but it also, in a sense, justifies itself by introducing norms that are quite common. And actually Hitler did not abolish the secret ballot, you know. He may have abolished lots of other things, but he didn't abolish the secret ballot in elections. People were still allowed not to, you know, to not to reveal what they voted for in the polling booth, you know. That's basically the point. If you have a Soviet regime, if you have a regime based on workers' democracy, the working class is quite open. You know, working class members openly argue with each other about what's right and vote on things. You know, what's right, what's wrong, whatever. But you know, a regime where there is a ruling body, that even if it's hidden, needs the comfort to the masses of being afforded the right to at least hide what they vote for from the bosses. And that's how it works under capitalism. That's the reason why you have a secret ballot under capitalism, you know, because the assumption is that if you didn't have a secret ballot, your boss would tell you who to vote for, you know, basically, you know. That is the fundamental point that he's making, you know, about the secret ballot anyway. So actually, Hitler didn't abolish the secret ballot. It actually makes the Soviet Union more like the capitalist countries, and it informally acknowledges that there is some other power that can persecute the proletariat when it votes the wrong way. That's the point that Trotsky was driving at, I think.
Thanks, Ian. Diana, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused by the secret ballot thing. I understand where you're voting for people. We have a secret ballot here, and presumably Hitler kept that. And Stalin introduced that. But when it comes to voting on policies and decisions, there's open discussion and open voting. Parliamentarians, you know, the MPs don't hide what they vote for in Parliament. They can't. And people don't hide what they vote for in meetings, and they have open discussion. So how much of this was hidden under Stalin? Was it just voting for people or voting about, or was it discussion about and voting on policies and decisions and stuff?
Well, I'll just come back on that very briefly. I don't think there was any real consultation of the population about practical decisions anyway, you know, about policy decisions. They were decided from above, and there's not really much pretense otherwise, you know. In the early Soviet regime, Soviets would actually discuss a whole range of things. You had a hierarchy of Soviets. You had a local Soviet that would send delegates to a higher body, which would send delegates to a higher body, to the All-Russian Congress of Soviets or whatever. Each of those bodies had deputies within them who were elected by the workers. If the workers don't like the way you vote, they'll remove you. They'll just say, okay, you're no longer the delegate. We elect a different delegate, you know. And that's how the Soviet system is supposed to work. It's the same with the Paris Commune. So, you know, it's a whole different model of the state, really, isn't it? You know, it's a whole different model of organisation. It's workers' rule means open discussion and open voting on everything, you know. That is the theory, you know. The Paris Commune is that everybody would elect delegates to a Soviet who would vote according to their conscience. But if the people below didn't like what they did, they'd remove them and have somebody else in their place, you know, who would take different decisions, you know. But it's all open because you couldn't be accountable for what you... If you got a secret ballot on matters of policy, I mean, in Parliament, people are actually allowed to vote according to their views in parliamentary discussions, but they are not removable in most cases anyway. They are elected for a fixed term of office for a party which decides those things by whip systems and all this sort of thing, you know. But in theory, according to Soviet democracy, it's all open, and delegates can be removed by their electors for voting in the wrong way. And there's a whole hierarchy of that, you know. So ultimately, the entire Soviet regime could be replaced with a different one if there's sufficient popular opposition to what they're doing, you know. And that's always been the case in terms of the model of workers' democracy, you know. If that's of any help.
If I may make a comment of my own, in a way, the Soviet system and the way Ian just described it, for me personally, is a bit like the relationship between individual trade union branches and their relationship with the local trade councils that they elect delegates for, because I'm a United Community member, and I was elected onto a trade council as a delegate from my branch. We have four delegates. At any point, if it's apparent that some of our delegates are not attending meetings, or they're voting in a way that the branch doesn't approve of, the branch does actually have the right to actually elect somebody else in their place. So even within capitalism, with the work of representative groups, i.e. trade unions, there is an indication of how Soviet democracy could work and has worked in the past. I just wanted to make that point, that was all, to expand on Ian's illustration, but in a modern day concept. Thanks. Does anyone else want to come in? Because I know, John, you haven't spoken yet.
I haven't got anything really to add. I mean, yeah.
Coming back to... Oh, sorry, Paul. Can I... I've got my hands full. Can I address Diane's question about from each according... You know, to each according to their needs, from each according to their... I've always translated it as from each according to their means. And I've always accepted that it was... that the, you know, the translation as abilities, this is about saying, you know, if it's in tandem with the Soviet free education, you know, free medical care, it is the expectation that each individual owes to society, to the people in general, that which they can give. Now, ability should also include not working them to death, but giving them that should be freely, that they work at that which they're capable of producing. But it is not expected that it's done at the expense of the individual, unless you're in time of extremis like invasion or war. It shouldn't be that everybody is worked to death. It should be that it's that you give freely of what you have, what you are able to give. I mean, certainly the criticism that people don't work as hard as they could do, or that some, shall we say, you know, DOS on the job, is you know, something that I think the Soviets always had to deal with. But the point was is that it was the local workers who defined whether or not their, you know, one of their comrades was, you know, not pulling their weight. No? So I don't think it's... I'm not sure why Trotsky reduces this down to peace work, as if whether, you know, that the Soviet is turning into Henry Ford's production line. It's about the Soviet being recognized as a communal organization coming together to produce what society needs. Thank you.
My own position on that is that I don't think it's Trotsky reducing it to peace work. I think he's arguing that that's exactly what the state was doing at that time. I think he was just saying it as he saw it. I don't think it was to do with his personal views of the matter. He was just analysing how the economy was structured at that time. That's my personal view, anyway.
But he hadn't lived in the Soviet Union for at least 5 or 6 years. And, you know, you're talking about depression, you know, a time of depression. You know, the Great Depression was still there until... 1939 and the begin, you know, the war, and to be you know, USSR was still under huge amounts of pressure from the, you know, the various empires and ex-empires of the West, wasn't it? The Soviet Union is, you know, the USSR has always been under threat of extinction from the British, the Americans, the French, the Germans. Yes. So they were always under siege. This has always been a case of, this, you know, the USSR having to fight to keep itself. In many ways, that's why Stalin chose to give up the international, you know, to turn his back on the international aspects of communism and stick to maintaining the Soviet state as a nationality. That's, you know, when he complains about the joining the League of Nations, it's because he wants the, you know, the Russian state to continue to exist. No?
Ian. You made it, Ian.
So I am. Yeah. Just on that, Trotsky was not complaining about the use of piecework. That's not what he was complaining about. What he was complaining about is it being judged as being a principle of socialism to use piecework, right? In fact, what it meant was that socialism had not been achieved, and they were still short of the material prerequisites from being able to really abolish the distinctions between classes. And create a situation where people were really no longer compelled to work longer than they would find fulfilling, and that would expand their capacities as individuals to contribute to society in a way without compulsion. You know, Trotsky was not complaining about the use of compulsion, or the fact that the worker state had to do these things. He was complaining about the ideological treason of saying that they were socialist measures when they're not. They're actually measures forced on the worker state by its backwardness. And therefore, only by two things. One is the international revolution, and two is economic progress within the worker state framework. Could that be mitigated? But he wasn't saying that the Soviet Union could leap out of the use, could abolish wage labour by voluntarism, you know, by just sheer effort, sheer intensity of effort, it could, you know, in the absence of economic progress. It could abolish wages, it could abolish piecework and all these things. He was not complaining that they existed. He was just complaining about them being dubbed as socialist measures, because socialist measures are the opposite. And in fact, the growth of inequality and the growth of a bureaucracy, the growth of a repressive state, were not signs of the achievements of socialism. They were signs that there were problems and that they couldn't get further down the road to genuine socialism because they had abandoned the international revolution and because they needed state aid from the proletariat in more advanced countries to allow that progress to continue. That's the point. He's not complaining about piecework. He's not complaining about wages system still existing. He's just simply saying that the existence of those things means socialism has not yet been achieved. And Stalin was telling lies to the working class by saying it had. That's the point, you know. And thereby, those falsehoods undermine the prospect for future revolutions because they became widely accepted. And it conservatized the whole world communist movement. That's the point. Sorry, I'll leave it there.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to come in? Diana.
There's a small point about what Trotsky was saying. Under capitalism, you have piecework, you have financial, you have material financial incentives for production. That's mostly true, but it's not universally true. That's not true for all work that's carried out for the support of the population, for example. I don't know whether it's still the case with the NHS is getting screwed, funny things done with it, but things like caring for people, that's there's no financial incentives to do that. I mean, there are paid carers, and then there's this paid medics, but there's nurses, doctors, etc. But there's no incentive for the people doing that work to actually care. And the same applies with teaching. There's no incentive for people, you know, for people to teach students well.
Thank you. And did anyone want to come back on that or to make another contribution? Ian.
Briefly. I mean, I think not every profession in the capitalism is simply geared to making a profit. There are concessions that have been made to the working class. The National Health Service is one of them. They're taking it back slowly but surely. They've been taking it back for decades by salami tactics, haven't they? But the original point of it was that it was a concession to the working class that was the result of fear of revolution, that if he didn't actually provide people with at least a simulacrum of socialist norms on questions of healthcare, you would get a revolutionary development against capitalism itself. And I think a lot of that, things like teaching as well, is to a degree, is that. The bourgeoisie needs to teach people to do to certain things as well, because they need an economy that has some workers are skilled and have knowledge of various things, you know, mathematics, science, language skills, whatever. I mean, they don't just need people to bash things with a hammer or something, you know. I mean, they do need some technical skills to compete with other groups of capitalists who've got skilled technical workers who might make all sorts of products, including, of course, weapons, but not just weapons, you know. There will be all sorts of things that they need to compete. I mean, this whole kerfuffle about technology between China and the US. The US is absolutely dependent on certain types of skilled labour to produce the material that it wants. Obviously China and other countries which are outside of imperialism, although China is very, very, I mean, there's a large capitalist element in China, you know. But capitalism is not just purely about profit from unskilled work. It needs skilled types of labour, and therefore you need education. And education is a kind of what's the word? It's a social part of the social wage that capitalism, whether or not it likes it, has to maintain as a separate thing that's not strictly linked to profit, you know. So yeah, you know, teachers don't work by piecework. Although, to be honest, there are things that go on in the way the Tories modified education over the period of the last 40 years that have tried to, you know, mimic that schools are meant to produce value and produce people of value, and if they don't do what the capitalists want, they get derogatory reviews from things like Ofsted and things like this, you know, get denounced. And you hear stories of teachers of head teachers committing suicide and things like this after being denounced by Ofsted. So it's not as humane and civilized as you might think, you know. It's geared for profit. It's geared for, it's not geared for purely for human need, but it's done in an indirect manner, I think, you know. Some things cannot be, you know, simply directly used for, you know, in a direct sense to make profit, but indirectly they're there to facilitate the making of profit. So it's very complex, isn't it? You know.
Yes.
For me, I think it's more complicated, and we're not given the socialism, if you like. I'm assuming that you're talking about that the peak of socialism in the UK is probably, you know, the post Second World War, you know, the Labour government that brought in the NHS and the education system. But it seems to me that that was much more about a society which had lost a great many, had suffered two world wars and was determined to recover from World War II in a way that it had struggled to recover from World War I by the introduction of the education system, which was not fair or equal, but actually divided people by using the grammar school system to provide lower and middle management jobs that could be filled by the children of workers on a competitive basis, and glass-housed the children of the upper and ruling class using the common entrance system to allow only the brightest of them to get through into, you know, the public school system, which was still very much funded by the state using taxes and its charitable status and its, you know, vast access to trusts and charitable trusts that have been set up, you know, even sometimes 100 centuries earlier, from large amounts of money, donations and land, etc. If you look at the charitable status of, you know, Slough Grammar, a.k.a. Eton and Rugby and Harrow, they're all very much part and parcel of we sustain them in order to provide the very best education to the children of the ruling class and, you know, the upper echelons of the three services and the diplomatic service. Now, if you're going for the NHS, which, you know, was the gold standard of providing people with medical care from cradle to grave, that was as much about trying to save the next generation after, you know, the real fear that there would not be enough people to reconstruct society, which is why when the Tories got in 51, you know, Enoch Powell was running around the Commonwealth trying to persuade nurses and doctors to come over from the colonies in order to, you know, fund this NHS that was going to nurture the, you know, the British people into as good a health as they could maintain. But the fly in the ointment was he was expecting all of those people from the colonies to go back home once they had done their job and provided the, you know, provided back. In some ways, it reminds me of Trump's current tariff system that he's going to give back to, you know, by the rest of the world for the great benefit that America has given everybody by being, you know, the world's police state. You know, with military bases occupying and the hegemon of the dollar. You know, we are, that isn't really what socialism was about. Yeah, when the Soviet state first came in 1917, the first thing they were interested in was one, equality between the genders, so it was equal pay, and two, it was the expectation that people would be equally valued, whether they were in, you know, it's the hammer and the sickle. It's the proletariat, the industrial workers and the agricultural workers, which is, of course, the first place that it goes. But you see that in Cuba, where everybody is trained as their job, they have a skill. But they have an academic one and they have a physical one, a worker's, shall we say, skill, and that they expect their people to recognize that both are equally important, that you can't just be on a job for life. And this is the, you know, the issue with teachers is teachers. You know, it's that infamous, I can't stand the guy, Alex, whatever his name was, who talked about, oh, well, those who can't teach. You know, it's the fantasy that somehow that teachers don't know what the real world is like, that academics don't know what the real world is like. And there is this divide. It's always a divide. You hear it over and over again from people who have worked their way up, who have worked all their lives, who look at, you know, the teaching profession, the civil service, the people who work in offices, because they quite rightly look at it and go, if you spent 30 years on a building site, you know, your physical health is not going to allow you to, you know, only retire now, I'm afraid, what is it, 66 or 68 that we're talking about? There is no way that you can work on a building site until you're in your 70s to collect your pension. And equally, you've got people who are doddering around, you know, the Houses of Parliament with their 80-year-olds who are still picking up £10,000 an hour for consultancy fees because it's not exactly as if they've ever worked all their lives, is it? You know, it's all about who you know, not actually doing a job. So what I'm trying to say is we have so many different systems, but we need, you know, but Trotsky doesn't seem to have any real recognition that society requires everybody to work together, but he can't just decide that it will have to be one group of people who are going to have the permanent power. It's got to be people working together, and that you need all of them to recognize that other people's skills are equal, but we all have to contribute to all aspects of society, and not just designate, you can't just designate one group of people, whether they're bourgeois or whether they're civil servants or bureaucracy or whatever, as being evil. Society wouldn't work if there weren't some bureaucrats. No?
Kinda.
Don't want them running it.
Yeah, just to comment about Trump and his tariffs to start with, because Susan raised that. I think I've seen that Trump's had to drop his tariffs on China because the US needs China's technology. And then that leads on to what I was intending to talk raise in the first place, is that if you are going to create and produce stuff, you need scientific and technical education, and you need mass scientific and technical education to, you know, to as many of the population who have the interest and ability to absorb that education. That happened a bit following the Second World War. I benefited from that. I was very interested in science stuff and not all the, you know, all the other bollocks. Sorry, I shouldn't call it bollocks, but, you know, the way it's taught, you know, history, it's all propaganda and lies and stuff. And I went, you know, so I was a bit, wasn't too keen on that. I've lost my thread a bit. Yeah, the public school system is terrible. It's useless. It doesn't teach the children that go to those schools, the privileged brats that go to those schools. It doesn't teach them what the society and the economy needs. It's Britain and that privileged school system has always been absolutely terrible with science and technology and maths and stuff, and pretty rubbish with languages as well, which are also important. And that's something that the Soviet Union, as far as I understand, it's not, Trotsky hasn't mentioned it, but that's something I get the impression they have got right. And it's something that the Russian Federation is getting right now, and it's something that China is getting right. But with the hardcore pushed neoliberal capitalism that the U.S. and Europe, you know, Western capitalist societies is now going. Where there has been some positive stuff with science, scientific, mathematical, technical, and education and languages, that's all been dropped. Certainly at higher education level. And I don't know what it's like in school, like, because I haven't got any children or grandchildren, never worked in education, so I don't know how bad this is now. But I suspect it's not very good. It's certainly rubbish at higher education level, which I do have some awareness of. And that's a contribution to why the neoliberal capitalist countries, economies are collapsing.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Well, given that I have got a background in education, I can certainly say, I mean, it was no surprise to me that with the money that came into Britain after World War II, that you suddenly got, you know, the 60s, which is, you know, if you think of 48 as the Education Act, then by the 60s, you have this massive flowering of young people, teenagers, you know, we're talking about, you know, not just the Beatles, but also the Rolling Stones. You're talking about this massive flowering of pop music that was popular music. It's music from the people, and there was more than that. There was so much, and it continued to flower, and it made huge amounts of money. But it wasn't run by the ruling class. What's shocking about, I listened to a fascinating YouTube from Whitney Webb talking about the money that is being made from rap music, from the violence of the, the what they call the bad boy, but all of that incredibly violent music of the 2000s, where they were literally being told by really powerful capitalists who controlled the music industry to write more violent music that would encourage young men, particularly young black men, to go out and commit crimes, because they were heavily invested in the private prison system, and therefore they wanted to fill up their prisons with what were going to, it was a money earner. And by controlling the sort of music that was being put out and the violence of it, it was, and the cynical misuse of it. And I'm looking at that, and you look at how pop music, which had been so financially rewarding that there was just buckets of money involved in it, then turned into the entirely manufactured pop world of the 1980s and the boy bands and the rubbish. And you get, you know, you are looking at the you know, the society becomes less creative, it's dumbed down. And again, you got this massive flowering of young people going to university. You got, science and technology improved. There were lots of things going on. And then suddenly it comes down because it's not sustained by the state in the way that the education system is. You know, and for want of a better word, it's not that people in Russia and China are so much brighter than the people in Britain or America. It's that they are not nurtured by a state which recognizes that they need to be fed properly, that they need to be taken care of physically and mentally, and that they need to be allowed to compete so that those people who are able to benefit from education, it doesn't have to be that it's all got to be STEM, you know, science and maths and technology, but they also value literature and art and creativity and music and a whole raft of things that allow all aspects of, you know, human development and progress to be valued within it. Yes, the technology allows them to make better weapons, to create more, to advance their, industrial powers and skills. But the point is that they are people who are giving people education and access to education and access to medical care because they see it as part of the recognition of humans as human beings. Whereas capitalism simply doesn't. It regards us as pairs of hands, pairs of feet, and whatever it is that they need to make profit at a particular time. And humanity is irrelevant. It's just about how much money can you squeeze out of this person by underpaying their wages for what you can get out of them before you end up. And, you know, you don't want to pay, you know, now it's about, can the hedge funds loot your pensions before you get to collect them? Because that's the, you know, that's the real money, where the money is going at the moment, is we have an aging population, which I'm afraid the capitalist system in America, and you know, the West, whether it's Britain or America, simply doesn't want to pay out on. You know, doesn't matter that Starmer's lost in the courts. The WASPI women are not going to get the £192 billion that's been looted from women's pension funds. It's not going, you know, they're not going to pay out on the medical bills for the aging population, which is increasingly less well off. They're going to bring in assisted dying, you know, and we are not looking at a society which is wanting more and more young people, because we are, you know, in Russia, they want, you know, they're paying for childcare, they're paying for people to have more children, to bring up more children in their society, because they recognize that people are a resource. In this country, it's about you just grab a few more people as illegal immigrants and you can ship them in, put them to work, and then you can relocate them back out of the system when you've extracted enough profit and back go for another batch of illegal immigrants. You know, we are looking at such a contrast. I know it's got off topic, but I never see any sign in Trotsky that he's really looking at the. I want to know what he feels about refugees and immigrants, immigration and emigration in a society, and how a society deals with it under socialism. Yeah, because it seems to me that that is the real enemy of socialism, is the capitalist exploitation of what in effect is slave labor, and the constant fear of the working classes that if they can't have access to slave labor abroad, or and of, you know, black and brown people, or whoever it is that they've designated as the serf or slave class, that they will then turn on the workers who will be reduced to slavery. No? So,
Ian, and then I want to make
answers,
Ian? And then I want to make a contribution of my own.
I'm not going to say much about that, because I think that could be a big discussion that could go on for hours. Okay. That's the problem, really.
Sorry about that.
We should probably actually discuss that another time, you know, because that's not really what he was talking about in this particular text. But it could be worth discussing another time, I do agree, you know. Just on the question of technical education and all the stuff that was being, I think there's different models of capitalism, isn't there? You know, there was a model, you know, there was a model of capitalism after the Second World War. There was a lot of state-owned industries and the like, which went hand in hand with technical education, with all the cultural infrastructure that went with that on a mass scale. But there was a change in policy, because they realized, because the bourgeoisie realized two things. One is that the rate of profit was continuing to fall through the whole of that period. It was becoming less and less profitable. And two, the technical means were coming to existence through technical progress to allow them to start flicking a switch and sending capital around the world, and the whole outsourcing business really got underway in the mid-70s. It was a change in economic model. so, you know, yeah, I mean, there has been an undercutting, and the outsourcing of heavy industry to countries with cheaper labour has actually had a very, very many effects on modern capitalism. You could argue it's created a situation where they've outsourced all their industry, and they cannot actually, they haven't got the productive capacity to win, to wage some of the wars that they used to be able to wage. And you see that in the Ukraine war, you know, and possibly in future conflicts they're likely to have to wage against, they're likely to want to wage against China. They might not be able to do it because they haven't got the technical means anymore. They've outsourced it in sort of, in pursuit of a fast buck. And of course, it's backfiring, you know. And that's what Trump's thing is about. Trump's tariffs are a desperate attempt to reverse that so they can actually get some industry back into the United States again, except I don't think it's going to work. But anyway, I mean, that's a different discussion. But yeah, I think there are different models of capital in different periods. And I think the difference is considerable. But the underlying motive is not that different. It's just different ways that it's expressed, I think, you know. But that is, we are getting rather off the subject of the text. Maybe we should have another discussion about subject related to this another time. You know, that's my view anyway. I think we should think about winding up fairly soon, actually, because it's getting late. Paul was just sharing anyway.
I'm guilty of replying to a subject that was already raised. Susan mentioned the subject of pop music in the 1960s, and I don't share the optimism that she said about the creativity, because the fact is, even pop musicians of that time were under the subject of the ruling class, in the sense that they were all writing for record labels. Apple Music was exploitative in the same way that record labels are today are exploited. And I could imagine their producer, George Martin, had quite a lot of say what they could produce and what they couldn't produce. I think something of artistry has always been present. Even in classical terms, you know, most composers during the Baroque era were stifled in some form because they were actually producing music for someone they were employed by, with the exception of people like Albinoni, who was actually quite rich, and he did have more freedom than, say, Bach or Mozart had. I know that's a bit off the subject of pop music, and nevertheless, it's beyond the subject that I'm afraid I don't share the optimism around pop music. I like listening to it, the old pop music, that sort of thing. But, yes, I'm under no illusions about the control of record labels and how, I start there. Jonathan got his hand up, and then Susan.
Yeah, just briefly on you know, this thing of different models of capitalism. I mean, one thing I've heard, and I don't dismiss it out of hand, but other people have heard dismiss it out of hand, is that Japan in the 80s deliberately crashed its economy so it wouldn't have to confront the US militarily. I mean, I don't know, that's just, I heard that from an ex-Maoist, and I've never dismissed that out of hand, but I know other people say it doesn't work like that. But I think it's a possibility. You just reminded me of that, someone said.
Oh, I'd agree with you, Jonathan, and also, and in fact, they appear to have just done it recently again. And this is part of the problem with Japan of being an American occupied country like South Korea, who has just had a military coup nearly take off because Biden was so desperate to win in Ukraine that they were hoping that they could access the 3 million or more South Korean military and reservists that they would be able to pour in, hence the weird stories about North Koreans fighting in Kursk. Yes, but the whole thing is in America, the whole financial system is teetering on the edge. I don't think that Trump ever had any intention of reindustrializing America, for the simple reason I was listening to Garland Nixon pointing out that they have blackouts with, you know, every heat wave on the weekend because they can't keep up with, they can't, they haven't got enough energy for the air conditioning systems to go on when there's a heat wave. So the idea that they could somehow sustain industry is ludicrous. This is not about that. This is about giving a financial shock that will reduce the value of the dollar. It will force interest rates that they want them to fall so that they can fund the war against China. And they have this, it's all about ideological hatred. And you see it reinforced. And it doesn't matter whether it's the British ruling class who ideologically hate Russia, like France and Germany, or whether it's America and the, you know, the yellow peril that they keep pushing down everybody's throat, you know, or the insane idea that somehow communism is, you know, still rife and going to try and take over America. You know, it's all about a military machine, you know, solving your problems by assassination. Yeah, cutting off the head of the snake, as they so cheerfully say, and bombing countries into back to the Stone Age, of which, unfortunately, you know, we can see from Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen, all these countries that they've just arbitrarily bombed civilians and infrastructure. You know, we may all be horrified by what's going on in Gaza, but we are ignoring the fact that every single year since 1945, the Americans have been bombing civilians in one country or many, several, and they had seemed to think that they can continue to be on top by continuing that same policy. And they, whether they do it through American, you know, bombing like they're doing in Yemen, or whether they do it through their proxies in Ukraine and Israel. You know, this isn't, you know, they have industrialized war while at the same time pretending that they aren't, that they are maintaining the peace. But, you know, Trump's tariffs are not, you know, look at them. They are now just opposed to China, and they've just had to remove 25% of them because 90% of the profit on an Apple iPhone that's made in China goes to the American people who sell it as an iPhone outsourced. Doesn't go to the Chinese. But the 100% tariff will simply mean, you know, this is why they've taken tariffs off iPhones and other technology. Yeah? Because the profit is actually made in America. But Trump and his cronies not being part of the, you know, tech, shall we say, aficionados, they just expect them to control Facebook and Google and the rest of it, just don't know, hadn't realized just how much they were already getting. But the system is breaking down because the billionaires do not want to pay tax. You know, his obsession with tariffs is down to the fact that there was an education system and there was, if not healthcare, but there was a system for protecting workers during the early 20th century, the end of the 19th century, because that was the only way that the American Republic, you know, the Republic could actually function and allow people to work. But it depended on a massive inflow of immigrants who came from Europe and were educated and were, you know, prepared to work for a new life and were part of that system. And that system worked in the end of the 19th century, and they stayed out of wars and just picked up the pieces like the hyenas that they were, whereas the ruling classes were still busy playing chess across the map of the world. But that isn't going to happen now. Now, look at them. They're talking about spheres of influence. Yep, and Lavrov has just announced that, you know, they're not. BRICS is going to have an equality of nations. It's not going to be three big nations squatting over the rest, which is what Trump and the few people who do want spheres of influence want. It's going to be a genuine equality of nations that the UN, you know, this is their horror. They don't want little countries to be able to say, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing in Yemen or Palestine because it's wrong. They don't want to be judged by people they regard as lesser. And, you know, that's been the problem of the ruling class forever, hasn't it? You know, they do not like the judgment of the people.
Before I sum up with the second, I know Dana and Ian have got their hands up, but I just want to ask before I bring Dana in, are there any comrades that want to say anything more about the text itself we've actually been reading? Otherwise, I think we ought to basically sum up. Dana, I think you'll probably have the last point before I sum up.
Yes, sort of related to the text, but kind of indirectly. For the last 400 to 500 years, Western Europe and then the US have been dependent on colonial and imperial exploitation of other exploited nations or other parts of the world. That's still happening, although the, you know, there aren't officially colonies, but the US and Europe and Australia are still treating other states, exploiting other states the way the colonies were exploited. Soviet Russia, I think the Tsars tried to be imperialist. They were imperialist, sort of, in their own region. They tried to create other colonies, but they failed. But Soviet Russia, following that 1917 revolution, Russia has never been an imperialist state and still isn't. So they have more of a culture, economic culture and background and infrastructure for actually providing for themselves. We don't have that culture or infrastructure for supporting ourselves. We don't know how to do it. The US doesn't know how to do it. Western Europe doesn't know how to do it. France can't do it. So that was more or less what I was going to say.
Okay, thanks. Okay, before I do the final summing up remarks, Ian, do you want to give an indication as to what we might discuss in the next fortnight?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, I think we should have some sort of discussion about, there are lots of things we need to discuss. I mean, we could have a discussion about China. We could have a discussion about the situation with what exactly the Trump stuff is about, the tariff stuff. I'm not sure at the moment. I mean, should we talk about that in the branch meeting, perhaps? Because I am
actually... Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
In that case, I'll make the final summing up remarks. Usually we hold the discussions every 2 weeks. So I think that takes us up to Sunday the 27th of April. In the meantime, I thank Conway for coming. And obviously in between now and the next fortnight, it's going to be the Easter holiday. So for those that celebrate Easter, I wish you all a happy Easter. For those that don't celebrate Easter, I hope you get a short break that you can enjoy for a few days. And so So I think we can now stop the recording and we can now go on to any other business.